Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. With me, Ben Emmett, and of course my co-presenter, John Dixon. And you can always catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie. Oh, I'm back. Yes, I think we may have lost you there. Yes, welcome again to the Astronomy Show here with Ben and John on dublincityfm.ie. The email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And tonight we have a very special guest with us. He's going to tell us a little bit about, actually, he has been here before, the well-known Kevin Nolan, lecturer and also author of the book Mars, a Cosmic Stepping Stone. And he's giving a talk next week, next Monday, to the IAS. And we might be able to give you some details about maybe how you can go along or log on to that, because I know it's on Zoom as well. But anyway, I think we have Kevin on the line now.
Try. Are you there, Kevin?
Indeed.
Yes, you that's okay. Yes, you were very, excellent. Very quiet there. And oh, my God.
No, I'm here.
We thought we had lost you for a moment. That's good. Great to talk to you, Kevin. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
Welcome back, I should say. I know it's a long time since you've been on this particular radio show.
It's always a pleasure, Ben. Love coming on. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, you're most welcome. It's great to have you. I was just saying there, you're giving a talk next week to the Irish Astronomical Society. And Indeed. If it's, we just want to get a little preview of what we can expect. I believe it's about what we're doing with all this data that we're now gathering on an absolutely daily basis now from Indeed. All these probes and telescopes and satellites. Mm. How we handle it and what we're doing with it. And how things have changed in the past couple of years in particular.
Yeah, I mean, the talk is called Big Data, Big Universe. So I suppose what's on all our tongues these days is AI, but while the sort of AI that we kind of witness on the web is kind of relatively new, this kind of technology has been kind of underpinning astronomy for about the last 20 years, certainly kind of big organizations building towards it. And not using these large language models, using, we've all heard of these other terms, machine learning, the ability to actually analyze enormous amounts of data. So I suppose then what I'm talking about is, it's not just that we are, I suppose, at a position where we got amazing computing. We're also in a kind of an era where the instruments we're building are absolutely extraordinary. The gigantic European space, Southern Observatory, extremely large telescope, 40-meter wide telescope, the Gaia space probe from ESA that's been up in space for about the last 10 years, gathering data, and then this extraordinary Vera Rubin telescope in Chile, which, just kind of put it in context, it's going to kind of image half the sky every 3 days at Hubble resolution. Now, if Hubble was to do half the sky, it would take it 450,000 years.
Wow.
And LSST will do it every 3 days.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And so with telescopes like this, they're just generating extraordinary amounts of data, as you said, and we got to think about new ways of analyzing it. But however, the talk is for the public, by the way. I should say that. It's not a technical talk going into all the computing. In fact, what really gets me going and buzzing in all of this, like for most of us in astronomy, is just the sheer scale of the universe. And it's why I call the talk Big Data, Big Universe, because really, we're being challenged by the scale of the universe. We're being challenged by, we're so almost kind of bored or numbed by numbers like trillions of stars and trillions of planets. But to stop and think about that, to stop and think about those vast sizes and what those numbers and what it means, and to try, even though we'll fail, of getting our head around those gigantic numbers. And what's really exciting about this time that we're living through right now is that we're starting to develop instruments and computers that can actually get a grasp of those sizes of numbers in a way that a normal human can't. So if you take Gaia, this space probe that's in space, it's been tracking with unprecedented precision 1.7 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy for 10 years or thereabouts. 1.7 thousand million stars. I'm going to show an image next Monday that has 80 million stars in it. What's that, about 1/20th the amount? And that is going to blow our minds. And Gaia is following 20 times that amount of stars at a canter. And the thing is that we have the instruments, the mirrors, the detectors, and then the back-end computing to cope with that. So in the past, exciting about this, in the past, where we would do one-on observations of individual stars and get amazing results from the likes of Hubble or even the James Webb Space Telescope, now we're in a position to actually do census of things like a galaxy. Literally, not just take a small sample, but a gigantic sample, a fair fraction of everything that's in the Milky Way, and monitor it. If you take this LSST I mentioned, over the next 10 years, it's going to track 17 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy and over 20 billion galaxies. And by that I mean take detailed measurements every 3 days of 37 billion objects. And that's outside our solar system. We're talking millions and millions of objects inside our solar system as well.
The big numbers are hard to comprehend. Those are impossible for the human mind to comprehend. I mean, we have an idea of what a thousand is, or maybe even what a million is. But when you get into billions and trillions, it's just...
Well, I read somewhere, actually, years ago, that people have a problem with anything greater than seven of something. That we start to lose kind of a sense of the numeracy of things beyond that. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But
well, I had to add something similar. Well, it was more or less that if more than five or six, if you look in a field and there's five or six, or you don't have to count one, two, three, four, five, because you just look and say, oh, I reckon there's five there. But when it gets above, six or seven, you have to go one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. But what about, just wondering about the legacy data, because I know sometimes when we cover on this program, somebody has gone back and looked at legacy data from Hubble, which has been publicly available for years, and then they say, look, I think I've discovered something that there just seems to be so much data already without having to bring in these, before we had to bring in computers and new telescopes and all the rest.
Well, the thing, you're right. I mean, there is a vast of legacy data. And I'll tell you, somebody in Ireland, actually, who's very much into this, doing big data analysis of legacy data, is a man called Professor Ushing Creener in DCU, who I know very well. He did research with myself and another colleague. And so you might talk to him to get him on the program as well. And he's very much into finding exoplanets from legacy data. He's worked on that. But the thing I'll say to you this, though, Ben, is that these are, although they're gigantic surveys, they're targeted surveys with purpose to try and understand things like gravitational waves, colliding black holes, literally, I mean, if you take the thing, a radio telescope project that's proposed for the next 10 or 15 years, the Square Kilometre Array, which is about 5,000 radio telescopes with an area about a square kilometre base, that's proposed to be in Western Australia and then South Africa and Namibia. But it again, would be supposed to be following about 30 billion galaxies radio signatures and almost observing the galaxies across the universe like buoys on the ocean to monitor where the dark matter in the universe is. So, it's a whole different way of thinking about monitoring the universe. And for old timers like us, Ben, we're used to one level of kind of thinking. This level of thinking enables us to think about trying to solve fundamental questions that we have on a bigger level. And by the way, when it comes to some of these surveys and then surveying objects within the solar system, like near-Earth objects or Kuiper Belt objects, I mean, these will help voyages, maybe even human voyages to the stars in 100 years' time. So we're doing the preliminary surveying, almost like the early mappers of the Earth for explorers. We're kind of, as I say, mapping the near Milky Way to unprecedented precision to enable journeys like you've seen what's it called, Project Hail Mary, which is a lovely movie, but that kind of thing, you know. So we're kind of in a new era and looking to a new era, and that's also another lovely part of these gigantic surveys, is that it's a new way of thinking about doing astronomy that I for one think is very exciting.
I presume we're not just looking and gathering this data in visible wavelengths. I know pictures of galaxies and such like, but I presume we're looking at them in, like from the data given, coming in from the James Webb, for example.
Well, actually, I mean, interesting to say that a lot of it is observable, which is great in one sense of that. We can then generate beautiful pictures. So the Vera Rubin Telescope, or some people might know it in the oldest name, LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So the thing about it is that it's optical. I think it's a 3 gigapixel camera on an 8 meter telescope. So the image they released last year was 250 times the area of the moon, but with Hubble quality detail in there. So it won't be generating beautiful images like that, but I'd urge people to go on and search for the first release image of the Vera Rubin telescope, because it is optical and it is generating stunning images.
And I believe it's likewise, already discovered thousands of asteroids. Oh
yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, with this Vera Rubin telescope, they estimate there'll be 10 million discoveries of new things in the universe every night. 10 million new discoveries, and up to potentially a million supernovae around the universe. And we're lucky to detect a few per year with current telescopes. That's the difference we're talking about. Then if you take Gaia, it's looking at the optical, but it's not taking images. It's measuring what's called the spectrum of a star, which is its color distribution. That tells us its makeup or its brightness, what we call its photometry. And then what many of these telescopes are doing is measuring the astrometry, literally the movement, the physical wobbling of them and the movement to detect what way are they traveling through the Milky Way and do they wobble because they have planets orbiting them and things like that. So there's a myriad, as you say, then there's a myriad of ways with which we're doing these measures. And then the Square Kilometre Array will be radio observations, of course. So you're right. We're doing many different kinds of measurements with these gigantic surveys.
They're amazingly accurate and precise, because if you look at the human eye now, I know back to the time of Tycho Brahe was probably was actually the best and well-known naked eye observer. That was before the days of telescope. But even today, you wouldn't notice over a lifetime, would we? If I looked at a couple of stars at the sky this evening and back in 100 years, would I notice?
I hear you. I don't think you would.
With the naked eye.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, it's funny because I know a couple of flat earthers, and one is a friend of mine. I hope he's not listening, but he keeps arguing why don't we see Polaris move? And actually, if you work it out, it's 470 light years, so that's 4,700 trillion kilometers. And then I talked about its movement, and yeah, sure enough, it takes around 25,000 years for it to move half the diameter of the moon across the sky. That's why you're not seeing it move. So yeah, right. This is Gaia is measuring these movements with incredible precision. So just absolutely, just extraordinary detail, and therefore able to, once we get these measurements, run the clock forward or backwards fast. So they're even talking about, for example, with Gaia data, which will be released by 2030. Just to put things in context, Gaia has finished taking its measurements, something like 3 trillion measurements it took. It's going to take astronomers with these big computers till 2030 to do all the calculations on those measurements, and then they'll release it as a catalogue, and then astronomers will start trawling through it. And to get back to kind of the public thing, anybody can access this data. It's apart from archive data, all the new data from LSST and from Gaia, for example, is free to anybody to analyze. So if you have any smart students out there, go and start Googling this and start exploring it, because it's available to everybody. But actually, to get back to Tycho Brahe, I was reading about him recently. Apparently, he had 3 or 4 times the visible acuity of a normal human being. And he also was a brilliant mechanical engineer. So that's why, without a telescope, he was able to apparently make measurements that were in the region of 15 to 20 times more precise than typical people with typical instruments of the day. Which is amazing to hear, isn't it?
Yeah, can I ask you a more personal question? You're talking about visual acuity, because I know myself and John have discussed this before. You know the double star system in the plough? Is it Duve or
Meser?
Or Meser? Don't know which one it is. I was just wondering, because I have never, my eyesight has never been as good as to visually distinguish between
them. No, I was wondering if you've managed that.
John claims he has.
I have, when I was a little fella.
Wow. That's amazing, actually. Yeah.
It is.
No, I've never, I've only, of course, true binoculars seen it, but never with the naked eye, no.
Yeah, I must say I was in my 20s, no. not today. Anyway, just go off the beaten track for a little bit. I was doing a little bit of research on you just through the internet. And a book or two that you might have floating around the place, and you're a quite popular guy now. One of these is called Mars, a cosmic stepping stone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And widely available worldwide at this stage. I can see it, and I was looking at it earlier on as well. Just go into that a little bit, because you're explaining the origin of the Earth, I suppose, and the overview of historical and current missions, etc.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you there's a lovely radio story associated with that book. I was giving lots of talks about Mars in the early noughties, and my sister heard a lady on RTE radio say, "I know I'm supposed to be all a bit excited about Mars, but I don't know why." And I remember kind of thinking, God, people like me, my talks just aren't working. And then I started to ask myself, is it really worth going to Mars? So I started to do a bit of research on this. I challenged myself, and when I looked into it, I found that actually in the 90s, in America in particular, with the likes of Carl Sagan, they really had felt they'd uncovered the notion that Mars was like Earth. And that, in fact, what they said it was, there's about an equal chance that life arose on Mars. And that really hooked me, and I thought, well, that's worth a science investigation. And that's been the cornerstone of everything about Mars in the last 20, 25 years is, not is there life there now, but what's the story of origins there? And you're correct, because the early story of Mars and Earth are very, very similar. Very similar. The difference is Mars still retains a record of all that early activity, because, as we all know, it kind of calmed down around 3 billion years ago. So I always say to people, if you want to find out how Earth formed, go and study Mars. And that's the reason why I argue we should explore it scientifically, because life originated here. The question then is, what does Mars have to tell us about origins? So despite the fact that actually over in recent years we had the Elon Musk saying we should go and colonize Mars, if anybody goes and explores, what have America, ESA and NASA done at Mars in the last 20 years with the Perseverance rover, Spirit and Opportunity? We've revolutionized our thinking about Mars. We know it has loads of water now. We know it was Earth-like in the past. We even know it was habitable in the past. And as some of you may have heard, we think we may have detected our first biosignatures of ancient microbial life there. So it's a very exciting, very complex, not dead world. And a world we actually are realizing we don't know very well. It's so complex, but a very exciting world. So I actually love the whole Mars robotic exploration. I'm actually not so keen in proposing we send people there anytime soon, because actually it's such a special place. You probably heard that some people propose that Mars, all of Mars, should be proposed to be a special place, meaning we got to treat it with the equivalent sterilization protocols as the Viking landers. And the reason why we're arguing that is because it's a scientific treasure trove, and you know, the long and short of it is there may still be microbial life there today. Isn't that an extraordinary thing to be able to say that we don't know the answer to that, but it's not preposterous to propose it? So I actually think that when people look back in the future to this time, they'll say one of the great scientific successes of this era was the robotic exploration of Mars by humanity, because we uncovered so many exquisite mysteries and answered so many wonderful questions about Mars. And by the way, it's continuing. So that's the fascination with Mars. I know a lot of people tend to get a bit jaded by it because they're kind of saying, yeah, we've been there, we've done that, let's go somewhere else. But for me, I just think because it's such a complex place and was so like Earth that it's worth engaging. And I'm not saying spend all our budgets on it, but, you know, every few years have a new, more intriguing probe to go there. I think it's wonderful science we do. I get very excited by it.
Yeah, just before we go a little bit further, if anyone wants to send us in a text or a WhatsApp, it's 0871791032. We'd love to hear from you wherever you are around the world.
And if you're in Ireland, actually, at the moment, the International Space Station is just about to fly over. If you have a clear sky at the moment, we're expecting it visible from about 7:49, which I believe is about a minute from now, to 7:55 p.m. The usual, going west to east, quite bright, actually a magnitude. Maximum magnitude today of -2.7. It's been brighter, but -2.7 is pretty bright. And if you're in Dublin, it'll be a maximum altitude of 38 degrees. But no matter where you are in the country, it'll only be a degree or two off that. Speaking of Mars, perhaps we should come a little closer to Earth.
Pluto.
Namely,
I love
John
is Pluto.
Obsessed with Pluto. Oh, we have. Is it a planet? No, we're not going there. We're going to talk about the moon and the return to the moon.
Oh, yeah.
John, you're going to have to wait another day for Pluto. Kevin, the Artemis mission probe, Artemis.
Yeah.
Actually, I always think it's a very, very well named because Artemis was the twin sister of Apollo.
That's exactly why they did name it that way, in fact.
So very appropriate. But Artemis 2 is, I believe, the latest window. I know they've cancelled it twice or pulled it back into the vehicle assembly building twice, but we're now, it seems,
once, was it?
Okay. Yeah. They had a hydrogen leak and then they had a helium leak, but they had to pull it back once. And the next window, launch window, is 1st of April, next Wednesday.
Yeah.
What's your take on it? Will it go?
I suppose for those of us of an older vintage, we've been following this for a long time. So just again, for anybody who isn't aware, we're sending people back to the moon. It's called the Artemis program. It has been in development for years, if not a couple of decades. And basically it commenced when the shuttle Columbia was destroyed in February 2004. Please hear me out on this, it's true. It's one of the few, I suppose, good things George Bush did as a president. He called a bipartisan committee and then developed a document called the Vision for Space Exploration, which was ratified both by the Democrats and Republicans. And the idea was, of course, to cancel the shuttle program and develop a new rocket called the Ares rocket. Basically, two Ares rockets would be launched into Earth orbit to build a Mars rocket to send people to Mars. And that was the idea at the time. Of course, Obama came along, largely cancelled and suspended a lot of it, and they rebranded it as a Space Launch System. And that's the rocket now that's launching to bring people back to the moon. And as we all know, in recent times with Starship and SpaceX come along, there's been this kind of divisive debate in America whether a Starship should be cancelled because it's not reusable. But however, the bottom line is that Starship is the only game in town. It's human-rated, it's as powerful, it's slightly more powerful than the Saturn V rocket. Actually, it's 1.1 times as powerful. And it's very reliable at this stage. It has been tested to the hilt. And Artemis 1, an unmanned mission, went to the moon in 2022. It worked beautifully. The Orion capsule, which is the pointy bit at the top, is much bigger. It's 5 meters across, 3 meters high, much bigger than the command module of the original Apollos, can carry four people for 21 days through space. And then the service module was built by Europe. So Artemis isn't just an American program. It's Europe, it's Japan, it's Canada and America and others as well. So it's not just going back to the moon. We're sending four people, by the way, around the moon for a 10-day mission. They're not landing on the moon. And they're going to just basically test the hilt out of every single aspect of this. So, for example, when they go in the door, they're actually going to detach from a thing called the interim cryogenic propulsion unit, and then they're going to do docking maneuvers with it in Earth orbit. So this is humanity going back to the moon, supposedly forevermore, to actually build potentially space station around the moon called Lunar Gateway, although there's question marks over that at the moment, certainly by the mid-2030s to build a lunar base in the southern pole, and up to 8 Artemis missions are planned. So Artemis 2, as I say, is to send people around the moon, 10-day mission, and come home. And by the way, this is an amazing statistic. 84% of the world's population alive today were not alive when Apollo 17 took place.
Wow.
So 84% of the world's population have never witnessed a person going to the moon. So this will be the first time for most of humanity to see people go to the moon. That's historic.
Kevin, we have a text in just quickly. It's from Aaron, one of our usual listeners as well. Good evening, Aaron. And he mentions that starships are meant to fly, which he's quite right about. And it's great to hear this interview. So he's enjoying it anyway. So, thanks for that.
Sure. I mean, the problem with Starship is that it's not human rated. So, in fact, actually, you know, I know this is kind of a contentious debate, but the problem is that, like, you know, it's decades behind. I mean, it was supposed to be built well over a decade ago. And the version of it that's supposed to land people on the moon called the Human Landing System is nowhere near complete. So despite the rhetoric about Starship and the calls to get rid of the Space Launch System, actually Starship is what's holding the whole Artemis mission up, because people were supposed to land this year on the surface. But the human launch system, or human landing system, the modified Starship is just nowhere near ready. And actually my deep concern, and I genuinely, this will come out in the wash in the next year or so, is even if Starship launches stably, it's so powerful, I genuinely believe it's going to take about another decade to human rate it. A human rating is a whole different kettle of fish in terms of the safety protocols that have to be in place for a rocket to be that reliable. So I think Starship is wonderful for the long term, but for the next couple of years, it's just not ready enough, if you know what I mean. So as I said, it's still very much kind of all to play for. And as much as a lot of people don't like the space launch system because they just think it's too old fashioned, as I say, it's the only game in town to get people to moon, and it costs effectively 1/6 per launch compared to Saturn V. So NASA, by having cancelled the shuttle, NASA can afford it. So it is cost sustainable, even if it isn't renewable. But anyway, all that kind of debating stuff aside, it is very exciting to see four people go back to the moon. And as they launch, they're very hopeful it will be on April the 1st. Like they've obviously brought back the vehicle assembly building, tested it to the hilt. So short of something else unexpected happening, we should expect to see a launch next week.
It takes an awful long time for that to get back to the garage, as we would call it, and then fixed up and then back at something
hours.
Like 11 or 12 hours.
12 hours, that's right.
What are you, Kevin, about the Artemis 3 originally was supposed to be a lander, but that was now not going to be. Artemis
that's
4
right.
will be the lander. Do you think they're...
I feel I'm always out of sync with what the popular view is, but for me, I just feel space is always a long-term game, so never be in a rush. So they've added a new mission to test the landing systems in Earth orbit. That just makes sense to me, because otherwise you would have been using new landing systems, whether they're from Blue Origin or SpaceX, live on the moon. You know, and I mean the SpaceX lander, by the way, is not that much shorter than Liberty Hall in town. Liberty Hall is 59 meters tall. The human landing system that SpaceX are proposing landing on the moon is 50 meters tall.
That's a big one. That's gigantic. Yes.
So a very big kind of, you'd be taking a very big punt to land it. And without testing it for us. So even though it will delay a landing, but it gives actually both Blue Origin and SpaceX, frankly, time they need to get these landers, built correctly. So I don't think there was any other option but to do what they did and add a new mission and launch that Artemis 3 to be tested in Earth orbit.
That's great. Kevin, thank you very much. We've run out of time.
I rambled on too much.
No, not at all. No, it's been great to talk to you. And we hope to have you in the studio next time. Our lovely new studios here. Because the last studios you were in when we were down in East Wall.
Let's
do it. Thank you very much, Kevin. We look forward to your talk next Monday. I'll give some details about that. Now, I know you can check it out on irishastrosoc.ie. Yeah. It's all there. And thank you, Kevin Nolan.
Cheers.
And we'll talk to you again. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's all from myself here and John here on The Astronomy Show. It's music all the way now until 2 a.m. here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Because up next, it's Dublin's greatest hits. And from 10 p.m. to midnight, Nigel Wood has his Ear to the Globe. While from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry in After Hours has his mix of jazz, blues and soul. Ooh, and in a nod to Seachtain na Gaeilge, did we miss it? I don't know. Anyway, beg me darash, ag an am chéine, lauhur taréis a seacht, an seachtain se chuing, leis an nuach de stéine a frod an crinne. Gdí sin, tawar ara, dá chéile agus gura magat ag isht, as eistach, abar íhawa a hián.
Íhawa, Ben.
Íhawa, seacht.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.